Introducing two new Subway melts. Try the new chicken cordon bleu melt stacked with juicy chicken, black forest ham, and melted cheese. Or the new $5 footlong chicken marinara melt. Tender chicken covered in marinara sauce and melted cheese. Melted goodness made irresistible. Subway melts. Subway. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to BS Report. December 16th, we're taping this, not sure when it's running yet, but we have the author of Eating the Dinosaur, the New York Times bestseller, a frequent guest of the BS Report, and he's the social commentator of the BS Report. I'm giving you that official title. Chuck Klosterman, you're on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. What's happening?
Merry Christmas, William.
You like social commentator? Do you want to be the czar of social commentary?
A czar? Okay, I'll take the czar title. Isn't anybody talking about society commenting on a social issue? Wouldn't that make everybody a social commentator?
Yeah, I guess maybe, because like Jacko and I just taped a podcast with him, and we talked about the Curtis Granderson trade for 20 minutes and about how what a great clubhouse guy he is, and how now that they have Curtis Granderson and Nick Swisher, who are apparently two of the greatest human beings who've ever lived, like what is this team capable of beyond baseball? Like they could actually heal diseases, and who knows what they're capable of. I don't know.
Well, those are elements of society. So
yeah, I think that's fair. So what's going on? Holidays.
It is cold. It is December. I guess there's a lot going on. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I think we have two major things to discuss, and they have nothing to do with one another, but the world needs your take on Tiger first. Let's hear it.
Okay. My take.
Give us a theory or something, a nugget that we haven't thought about yet or that might change the way we're thinking about this, if you have one.
It might change the way we're thinking about it. Well, I mean, I feel as though everyone is sort of coming to the same kind of conclusions about this, right? I mean, he was somebody who lived a completely secret life, and the assumption was that he was doing this for, marketing and promotional reasons, but as it turns out, he was living a very dark, very strange life, and he had reasons not to talk.
Mm.
But you know what Errol Morris says, you know, you can't trust somebody who doesn't talk about themselves, because how else will you know what they're thinking? The only way we can understand how someone views the world is what they say about themselves. And he never did. So I don't think anyone is surprised he was having an affair. I think everyone is surprised by the magnitude of people he was involved with simultaneously. And it's really interesting. Everyone comes out and says, you know, what an idiot he is and what a bozo. How could he have, you know, it's so obvious he was going to get caught. He actually did keep this under wraps pretty successfully for a long time.
And
don't you think so?
Well, it seems like he may have been caught 2 years ago by the National Enquirer, and then something happened, and he ended up doing the cover of Health and Fitness magazine, and they didn't run whatever story they had.
Well,
that was the only time.
Yeah, they didn't have enough there. I saw one clip of a porn star from like 2006 talking about having sex with Tiger Woods, but because he had done nothing at that time to sort of implicate himself, it just seemed kind of like idle gossip, you know.
Well, what is it about being a celebrity, whether it's a politician or a superstar athlete or a musician or whatever, that just seems like fidelity is just stops becoming an option at a certain point?
Well, it's not that it stops becoming an option. It's similar to the fact that the qualities that tend to make people great also tend to create their demise. I mean, the reason like somebody, say, like, you know, Dan Marino or whatever, plays too long, and like ends up playing, or the reason Michael Jordan may have played too long, is because the desire to sort of succeed and be great is sort of what initiates sort of success, and also then sort of kind of runs out at some point. I mean, I think that Tiger Woods was successful probably because he sort of views himself as an almost immortal figure. that basically the rules of both sport and society don't really apply to him, so that he can sort of move beyond that, you know?
So there's, because I've thought about this too, and it seems like to be really, really super great at anything, whether you're a politician or whether you're Michael Jordan in a game seven, you need to have this supreme level of confidence that other guys can't really attain. Now, if you have that confidence in that venue, then maybe you have the same confidence that, oh, I can do this. I'm not going to get caught. I'm who I am. You know,
well,
and then maybe
Although, at the same time, I mean, you know, okay, what figure is most comparable to Tiger Woods in golf? Jack Nicklaus. Jack Nicklaus seems to have been a model husband. There, if you watch the Jack Nicklaus Sports Century, somebody talks about how, like, they caught Jack Nicklaus making out with his wife in an elevator after they'd been married for, like, 25 years or something,
right.
You know? So it doesn't, it's not as though you can, or that only a certain kind of person can be both great and then sort of, you know, inherently problematic at the same time. I don't know if that's true. The stuff about, you know, now they've linked Tiger to this, you know, this doctor, this human growth hormone doctor guy. I mean, it is odd now. I mean, now on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of surprise, it's like a negative 19. I mean, I now assume that he probably is doing something illegal. If I had to, if I actually had to put money down, I would not be surprised, because it just, you know, he really put himself in a tough ethical position here, you know.
I read this column today by Bill Plaschke of the Los Angeles Times, and the theme of the column was that he saw Tiger Woods a couple years ago in person, and Tiger was so ripped in person that he was just like, oh my God, and in the back of his head, because baseball has taught us not to trust anyone anymore, the PEDs started floating around his head, and now that this whole Tiger thing, you know, the cheating part came out, the thesis of his column, and this was his exact quote, if a guy is a chronic cheater off the course, what kind of leap is required to believe he could be the same sort of cheater on the course? Do you think that's true?
Well, I mean, that statement, yes.
I mean, do you think that's a fair statement for a writer to make?
Well, it's interesting, because if you reverse those qualities, it doesn't hold up at all. For example, if somebody cheats on the field, we don't immediately assume he's cheating on his wife.
Yes.
Somehow, when you reverse it, though, it seems more sort of central to his character. That if Tiger is sort of this kind of cheating person, that every quality of his social life is sort of infused with this attempt to get over and sort of kind of just have what he wants regardless of the consequences. It does seem strange that he would say, in this one sliver of my life, a big sliver, obviously, is he's a pro golfer, but in this one sliver, I would never possibly bend the rules. I guess, I don't know. He doesn't look, I mean, he looks ripped, yeah, but he doesn't look unnaturally so. I mean, but then again, why would any golfer get unnaturally sort of ripped? Here's one thing I'll say about this, though. I do think I know how Tiger could salvage sort of his reputation and, by extension, his career.
Yeah.
I think that there's two things he needs to do. One, at this point, the number of mistresses that come forward is kind of doesn't matter now, right? Once you get above, say, 4, it doesn't matter if it's 9, 15, or 30. So he should have some of these women come forward who say things like, you know, he paid for my chemotherapy. Or he should sort of mix in a few different kinds of women, because he clearly has a very specific type. And I think, you know, this fact that he supposedly is with one who was like 40-some years old, this I think she's being called like the Tiger Cougar or whatever, I mean, that helps in a way, you know. And he needs to sort of seem as though he has sort of a kind of a wider palette of interest. But the big thing that he needs to do is he's never, ever talked about himself in any way. He's never given this interview that was really sort of kind of elucidate what he's like as a person or whatever. So now he needs to go the complete opposite way. He needs to become like Barkley now. Like he should say, like he should admit that he had this sort of secret life, and that people around him convinced him that he should not be himself, and now he's really going to be himself, and just become this totally outspoken person about race, this totally outspoken person about sort of wealth, about Nike, about, you know, he should become really political. Then people in the long term would look back at this event as sort of when he actually turned the corner and became who he really was.
I like that.
But if he tries to continue just like, I'm gonna do nothing, I'm gonna say nothing, I'm just gonna take 3 months off to fix my marriage, which is playing a divorce now, but regardless, kind of comes back and plays golf, every time he fails on the golf course, it'll always come back to this one event. But if he moves forward and becomes sort of this hyper-aggressive, outspoken character, then he becomes a more interesting person, and most importantly, the media would decide they love him again. If they started seeing him as somebody who, if that Tiger just created controversy with everything he said, suddenly this would just become like the domino to a much more interesting person.
Follow-up thought on that. All of this trouble started because Tiger gave that one interview to Esquire when he told the jokes that he thought were off the record and the guy ran.
Now, that Charles Pierce, how did that Charles Pierce article have anything to do with this?
Well, I'm about to explain it to you.
Okay. Well, I'll be interested.
So, as the theory went, from that point on, Tiger decided, I can't trust the media. I'm going to control all the situations. And that's really what led to how he handled the media the next 12 years that allegedly he got burned in this one interview. I would flip that around and say, maybe the people who are advising him or who are in charge of him, maybe Tiger's just not a smart guy. And telling all those jokes in front of a writer who has a tape recorder is not the act of somebody who is the sharpest tool in the shed, in my opinion. So maybe they were protecting him the last 12 years to a certain degree.
First of all, the things that he said in that piece, they only seem surprising because he had never said anything else interesting in his life.
Yeah, but what are you telling dirty jokes in front of a reporter for? That's just stupid.
Well, he was a relatively young person at the time. I mean, Charles Pierce is kind of a smart, sort of charming guy. I suppose he maybe made Tiger feel really comfortable, and maybe he felt like, well, this is a real writer or a serious writer. I can sort of be myself, and maybe I'll see what happens. And then, of course, when it didn't work, then it did, I think, kind of accentuate his desire to kind of close everything down.
But that's my point, though, is that maybe they just overreacted to that one interview, and then they got comfortable in this whole thing of, well, hey, we don't need the media. They need us. We don't need them. And that's been their attitude the last 12 years of, you can have Tiger. Like the time I interviewed him, I had 10 minutes to play a video game with him, and that was it, and I had to get your ass out of there. And that's how they've controlled the media for 12 years.
But tell me this, though. Okay, let's say he had talked to the media consistently over the last 12 years. How would that play out any differently now? I mean, this is one thing. It's like when the story just started breaking, I mean, now it's completely out of control. But when it first started breaking, people were like, will Sports Illustrated or whatever put Tiger on the cover and deal with this, because will they be afraid that, he'll never give them access again? Well, why would they be afraid of that? He never gave them access before. Why would anybody now feel like, I don't want to damage my relationship in the media with Tiger Woods,
See,
I guess he has no one to go to, basically, to give his side of the story. But what possible explanation for this can he give that would somehow not seem worse?
Right. But, I do feel like the way the media has reacted to this, the media hates when people won't talk to them. When somebody who is a public figure who is important just says, I don't need you. You need me. I don't need you. I'm going to control the way that all of our interactions go. So that anytime that person stumbles, then it's like, we got him. And it's like, oh, you didn't need us? Watch this. And that, I do feel like that was a small part of everything that happened here. You don't agree?
Well, it is. And there's this, I was talking about this with another friend of mine who had taken some classes sort of in the publicity philosophy, like the philosophy behind publicity and the philosophy behind crisis management. And the reason all the people in the publicity world say Tiger has to come forward is because he says that when a celebrity does something wrong, if they come forward and they apologize, even if the apology seems completely fake and completely rote, it then sort of puts the pressure on the consumer, because the consumer now has a choice. I can accept the apology or I cannot. which is really comes down basically to the morality of each individual consumer. Do they want to identify themselves as the kind of forgivable person, or are they just going to be stonewalling and saying no? So that's why these people think that Tiger needs to come forward and give some rote apology. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I don't know how much it would help now. He might be better now doing nothing and just waiting it out. You know?
Well, I think there's a real chance that he knew that that was the right move, but maybe his face wasn't in the kind of shape that he could speak publicly yet.
Wasn't in the right shape?
I think maybe he might have had some facial injuries. And, you know, I think it's very interesting that we have not seen him on camera yet, and now it's December 16th. Like, this happened 3 full weeks ago.
And, well, but if you're not talking, you're not going to appear on camera.
Well, but you're doing statements, though. You're putting statements on your website. I'm saying, like, maybe he couldn't talk to anybody in some sort of interview situation because his face is messed up for whatever reason.
Well, I mean, these are all minor scales, of course, because his celebrity is so huge. But if you did something in your life that was if you did something knowingly wrong, okay, would you address this in a column on Twitter, or would you try to just wait it out? What would you do if a smaller calamity happened in sort of your smaller degree of fame?
I don't know. I don't think I could do anything that would approach what, you know, Tiger is the biggest athlete of this generation.
Oh yeah, he won the Athlete of the Year today by the decade by the AP today, so, which is not a great time to win that award, you know.
Yeah, because it's sort of like
winning the Nobel Peace Prize right before you go into Afghanistan.
Right.
It kind of accentuates a lot of other kind of, you know, the any problems and any perception you might have.
But I think this is what people, when they're like, you know, oh, why are we tired of this story? Why is this such a big deal? It's a big deal because this was the biggest athlete since Jordan. In my lifetime, there have been 3 athletes that transcended everybody else, and he's one of the 3. I look at, like, could play the people are playing the whole thing about society's changed and we eat this stuff up now. And you know, there was, you look at what happened with George Foreman and Muhammad Ali and Zaire, and the famous story about he started fooling around with Veronica, who ended up being his 3rd wife, and his wife flew across the globe to confront him. They had this huge fight in his hotel room. Like, that was worse than anything that's happened with this Tiger thing. And the media knew about it and they didn't write it. So, I mean, how much different do you think the media is now than 1974?
Well, I mean, the size of it, it's probably, I don't know how many times bigger, but certainly 10 times bigger. I mean, you know, that might be sort of a, no, it's even bigger than that. It's probably 30 times bigger. Because what they're, you know, okay, so this event happens on Thanksgiving, more, you know, there's like, you know, the day after Thanksgiving or whatever. I mean, there was a time in the very recent future where that would have been alone to essentially kill the story.
Yep.
You know, I mean, that's like when Chaminade beat Virginia that year in basketball, it happened like, you know, on Christmas or Christmas Eve or something. And that is part of the reason why that game is still gone. And it's just this little small fact, because there was just this, there would be these huge drops in all coverage. I mean, it used to be a very easy thing to do politically, that if you wanted to announce problematic information about your own administration, you would sort of do it late on Friday. But that doesn't even help anymore. I mean, there's just, you know, so the fact that Tiger's story immediately became, there were so many sources to talk about this. I mean, people looking on Facebook updates and on Twitter and all that stuff, that they were talking about it at, like, their little holiday gatherings on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That when it started to sort of morph the next week, they were all really ready sort of to just kind of keep going on this. I mean, that, you know, who, when Foreman and Ali fought, I mean, there was a lot of big-time journalists there, but when did the actual stories about that come out, besides the outcome of the fight?
Yeah, media was
weeks.
Totally different then. It just makes me wonder, like, you know, I love the Golden Bear, Jack Nicklaus, one of my favorites, but you just assume that he was, you know, because he, on that SportsCentury and the story he made on his wife, he's a family guy and all that, but we don't know anything about the guys that we grew up with, because none of the media would have told us whether they were doing anything or not. Ali was covered up. Ali was, like, not a great guy. Like, he really wasn't. And the way the media treated him, and really there's only been a couple authors who have even gone there and pointed out that, wait a second, this wasn't a great guy. This was a guy that, you know, turned Joe Frazier, like, you know, used race to basically turn the country against Joe Frazier, who brazenly cheated on everybody that he was married to and was like kind of a mean guy in a lot of ways.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
This was covered up.
No question about that. Yeah. And although, you know, I will say this, it does seem like over time, reality does come out. You know, I mean, like you say, nobody said these things about Ali, and that's true. In the mainstream media at the time, there was nobody who would take a shot at Ali except for things like, you know, not going to Vietnam or whatever, very safe things to attack a guy for. But well, once he sort of became this lion-eyed figure, he was sort of bulletproof for a while. But now here we are having a conversation on a podcast that's going to be on ESPN, and we're talking about sort of the problems with Ali.
Yeah.
So over time, the reality of these things come out. Even if Tiger had hid this his whole life, there would be a point probably where some of these people would come forward. There would be skeptics, but people close to Tiger would say something. Maybe Tiger would make some admissions. Over time, I think that, you know, we probably would have got a picture. But because it happened all at once, because he had absolutely no agency in the decision to bring this forward, it kind of all came down like a house of cards on him. You know?
Coincidence or more than a coincidence? Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, Mickey Mantle, Pete Rose, Jim Brown. Like, these were guys who were the greatest at their sport for however period of time and revered, and all had some sort of dark side.
Mm-hmm. Is it a coincidence?
Is that a coincidence, or is the same, like what you were talking about earlier, the same kind of whatever you need to make it beyond everybody else in the sport also means that you cannot be a totally fantastic person?
Well, you know, that's really tough. I mean, I guess I started this by sort of suggesting it's not a coincidence that the kind of things that drive, you know, because success in sports is a weird thing. It's, you know, it doesn't, you know, really, while it sometimes seems like a metaphor or a reflection of life, it actually is completely detached, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can be a certain kind of person on the court or on the field or something, with, you know, essentially, yeah, a nihilist almost, or you can succeed. If, you know, you can be a great, you can be a nihilist and be a completely successful baseball player. There's no question about it, right?
Yeah.
So, is it to your advantage to be sort of a less empathetic, meaner, self-interested kind of objectivist as an athlete? Well, probably.
Yeah,
of course,
I think it is.
There are exceptions to that. I mean, so it's not like one is impossible, but. But this is always with anybody who's famous like this. If somebody is really great, transcendent at one specific idiom, whether it's sports, film, music, writing, whatever the case may be, if somebody is really great at this one quality, there is sort of every other standard in their life becomes looked at in a different way as well. I mean, why would, for example, the fact that Jim Brown was an incredibly fast, powerful runner, why would that have any relationship with how good of a boyfriend he was?
Or O.J. Simpson, same thing. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what to think. I don't know if it's something in your DNA that makes you great but also causes the resulting problems, or if you reach a certain point and you become so famous and so successful and so revered that you just, there's no way to handle that properly. I mean, look at all the famous people that this country has driven crazy, like Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Michael Jackson, like it does some Britney Spears. It does seem like it's pretty rare for somebody to hit that level and then kind of keep a level head too.
Well, or is it just that if you investigate anyone's life, you're going to find problems? I mean, the only lives we investigate are famous people, but...
Bruce Springsteen? Like, he seems like a good guy.
He does.
Is that safe to say?
Although
good friend?
I think there was that his first wife would disagree with you. Didn't he leave his wife for somebody who was in his band on the road? Now, granted, that's not like murdering somebody, but, you know, her perception of him would not be that he was a good
guy.
I think they
broke up, and then he ended up with the other person. I don't think the boss straight. I think he might have had a dalliance with Clarence Clemens. but Springsteen to me seems like I become more and more fascinated with him as time goes on, because this is somebody that has not really changed in 40 years. Like, you watch, You ever gone on YouTube and watched like Springsteen clips from 1972 or whatever? And then you see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame concert, the 25th anniversary. It's the same act. It's the same energy. It's the same enjoyment. Like, I can't figure him out.
There's two ways of looking at that, though. The optimistic way is saying, like, well, he was always the authentic person he actually is. You can see because over time, he's remained that person. Mm. By the same token, is it natural to remain the same person for 40 years? Does that somehow indicate that the way he acted, both at the beginning and now, is more constructed than a lot of other musicians who change over time? I mean, yeah. I feel like a totally different person than I was 5 years ago. I feel like I write very differently than I did 5 years ago, and that's a short window. It would seem very strange, and it would say something probably pretty weird about me if I did the exact same thing in the exact same way for 40 years.
Yeah. And also, I'm just fascinated by Springsteen. And another thing that fascinates me is, and I think we've even talked about this before, is the fact that you two can still get together and write songs and come up with riffs for them and make albums after, how many years has it been now? 30? 31? Without breaking mm-hmm. up? Without anybody saying like, oh, I've had it with The Edge. I've had it. I'm tired of his BS. I need a break from this guy. These guys are like a four-person married couple. I think that's also incredible and a little bit weird that they are really the only band that has stayed like a nucleus like that tight for that long.
Oh, it is. That actually I think it says a lot about the drummer and the bass player, because essentially U2 is a situation where Bono has always been the leader of the band who makes all the decisions and basically even dictates whether or not they're still together. The Edge is the main musical component, so he has a certain sort of power over Bono because he's so central to the way they sound. But then the other two guys, who are, you know, talented musicians but basically get out and push a lot, kind of do all the other work, they're the ones who seem to be, the most sort of... They have the right level of self-esteem.
Yeah, they're the most malleable.
What?
They're the most malleable. I've always thought they're like a basketball team, and if you were going to compare them to one, it would be the 96 Bulls, because Bono's obviously Jordan, Edge is obviously Pippen. Or I should say The Edge. They don't like just calling him Edge. It's The Edge. But then the other two guys are basically Luke Longley, Steve Kerr, Ron Harper, and everybody else. They fit in. Well, they play roles. They're happy with it. They're happy to be there. They're going to run over to Jordan and hug him when they win the title. They know what they appreciate a good thing.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I would guess, I mean, they're aware of both their abilities and their limitations, you know, and that's a hard thing to do. In some ways, I think having a real awareness of your strengths and limitations is almost more difficult or as difficult as being great.
It seems like the thing that keeps a band together is the second guy and how he handles. And I thought Almost Famous, this is one of my favorite things about it, is it kind of captured that dynamic perfectly, because at some point in a band, one guy is going to be the guy and then the other guy has to accept that. He might have some dalliances as being the guy in a concert or whatever, but ultimately he's the second guy. And that has been the root of almost every problem in music history. You know, it all comes down to one thing.
In all those groups, I mean, say the Rolling Stones, for example, where you have two principal guys, right?
Yeah.
The guy who is in the slightly inferior position in terms of dominance is going to always be perceived as the coolest guy.
Yeah.
People will always like that guy more. And if that's enough for somebody, then it's no problem. The problem is when the guy who's perceived as cooler wants to also be the dominant person. And that's when things go wrong.
Did you see the 25th anniversary concert?
I watched a lot of it.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I had so many mixed feelings on it. I'm still sorting them out. But one of my favorite moments was, so Bono's on the stage with Springsteen. Did you see that part?
Mm-hmm.
And Bono starts going into this whole, you know, he's doing basically his SNL sketch of himself. He's talking about some important cause and bringing the mood down. And Springsteen just comes over and he says something like, hey, how about we bang out a song? And like, he just like kind of makes fun of him, and then they start the song, and Bono's kind of like, for a second, you could see, he's like, how dare you interrupt my very important rant about whatever I was talking about. But
yeah, I thought that was staged.
Oh, you thought it was?
I feel like Bono is the kind of person who backstage would have been talking with Bruce Springsteen, and he would have said, you know what would be funny? If we sort of made a play on the caricature of ourselves.
Really?
I'm going to say something over the top and sort of serious. Because here's the deal. Bruce Springsteen, as a person, it's very unlike him to do that. And it's not like him and Bono are such good friends. They're not hanging out all the time. But he's going to tease him kind of like that in public on this major stage on HBO. It's just not going to happen. I feel like that was something that they probably, I think it was kind of a smart construction. But it was basically one guy making fun of himself and the other guy being able to sort of establish his existing ethos.
Wow. It fooled me because I thought Bono seemed like, just like a smidge, like I feel like he would have eventually like smiled or something.
I don't believe much of what I don't believe much of what I saw on I see on TV.
I'm going to break that down like it's a Zapruder film after we finish this podcast. So this whole rock and roll. I have a couple of things because I never got to talk about this. So thank God you're here. It's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. God bless Stevie Wonder and all that stuff, but what does he have to do with rock and roll again? Did we change the Hall of Fame? Is this now the Music Hall of Fame?
Well, so you really only want rock acts in there.
I guess I'm just confused.
You don't think ABBA should have been in? They got in today.
I guess I'm confused by what the Hall of Fame is. It sounds like it's the Music Hall of Fame. Just change the name.
Well, no, the Music Hall of Fame, you have to have blues people. You'd have to have classical musicians. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when people use the term rock and roll now, that is the umbrella for basically all popular music from the early 50s on. So there's going to be hip-hop acts in there over time. You know, they're putting pop acts. Because people rarely even use the term now, rock and roll. It doesn't really have – it's a meaning when it was – originally sort of created, and now it's just sort of an umbrella term, I think.
Okay, so you're saying
you'd have no Motown artists in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? That seems weird. I feel like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be in Detroit.
I I'm confused by what it is, because like if it's the Motown Hall of Fame, I know what it is. It's going to be all the people who did Motown. In my head, I always thought Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was like the Kinks, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, like a certain type of music.
Okay, so how would you then?
I was also confused by Simon and Garfunkel.
What do you classify as the criteria for a rock and roll band? What are the essential elements that a rock and roll band has to have in order to qualify under sort of your vision of this?
I would say rock and roll would be, you know, I think it would range from maybe the solo guy like a John Mayer.
Now, don't say artists. Say the criteria of what those people, the unifying elements of rock and roll artists.
I feel like there has to be a guitar.
Okay, there has to be a guitar. Okay.
There has to be. And there has to be drums. And there has to be a lead. Yeah, I guess there doesn't have to be a lead singer, but it would be nice. But the guitar is the essential thing to me. And if it's not there, I'm not sure if it's rock and roll anymore. I always associate rock and roll with guitar and then hopefully four guys just making music. Like, to me, it would have made much more sense.
Does there need to be a bass guitar?
Not necessarily. Like, the White Stripes,
okay.
You know.
Okay, so or the Doors, you're fine with that. But there does need to be a lead guitar.
So, it's kind of one of those, you know it when you see it. And to be Stevie Wonder, I don't think anybody was ever like, I'm going to a rock and roll concert tonight. It's Stevie Wonder. Like that part, ooh, or the same thing,
How many decades has it been since someone has said, I'm going to a rock and roll concert tonight?
It's true. It would be out of, like, the early 70s. Like, Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry, wouldn't you say that was, like, the start of when rock and roll became rock and roll?
Jerry Lee Lewis is playing on a piano. What about Jerry Lee Lewis songs that don't involve a guitar?
I think if you're using the piano violently...
Keyboards, in your mind, keyboards can replace the guitar.
Well, see, because I feel like Billy Joel should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he did all kinds of music. He did music that there were some songs that felt like rock and roll songs to me, and then there were songs that were Billy Joel songs. I don't know. I guess this is the Music Hall of Fame. I'm fine with it.
I feel like, to me, if you say you're using the term, you kind of know it when you hear it. I feel like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame encompasses all the acts that are understood to sort of play the music that modern teenagers like. And a modern teenager starting in the 50s, sort of. you know, if it's not, I mean, I don't know, because there's not going to be like a, I mean, I suppose there is an R&B Hall of Fame somewhere, but I wouldn't have any problem with Stevie Wonder being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That seems kind of obvious to me.
Well, what about Dr. Dre?
Dr. Dre, I would say, will, I mean, I would certainly induct N.W.A. into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay, so basically you're telling me that this is a music Hall of Fame.
Music Hall of Fame would be like, who's the greatest bluegrass artist? They go in two. Who is the greatest, John Philip Sousa should be in the Music Hall of Fame. This is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Because people know what you mean. When you say nobody would say that they're going to see a rock and roll act and then go see Stevie Wonder, people know, though, that Stevie Wonder is part of the rock and roll idiom, that elements of modern rock and roll come from some of his early Motown songs.
See, I just felt like, to me, it's like you got to choose, and to me, he's Motown.
And that's a label. Motown's a label.
No, but you know what I'm saying, though. Motown is like Stevie and Smokey Robinson and the Supremes, and then it...
Yeah, they were all on that label. What is it? I mean, that's...
No, but then it moves to the modern age, and it's like maybe Whitney Houston. I don't know if she was a wrist, I think. But
so you want like a soul Hall of Fame? There should be a soul Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I'd like a soul Hall of Fame. I don't think we're doing a good enough job. To me, saying like we're gonna have a rock and roll Hall of Fame and everybody's in is like saying we're gonna have a sports Hall of Fame and it's all sports. Like I'd rather see a baseball, football, basketball, hockey, golf. I think we need to differentiate it much better.
Do you put pop music in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I don't. Like, I don't think Britney Spears is rock and roll. Is Limp Bizkit, like, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I don't know.
Well, I don't think Limp Bizkit's going to make the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, like, you know, but, okay, so, like, okay, Ben, with the exception of the Monster record, R.E.M. doesn't play a lot of, I mean, they play pop music. But I think, I'm sure you would assume they would be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes. I mean, I would think... Anybody who is like a college alternative or a college indie band or an old school, like remind you of rock and roll bands or the old rock and roll band, like Bad Company to me is like a rock and roll band.
Okay, so you would say Bad Company should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
No, I wouldn't. I'm not saying that. You're doing the Klosterman thing.
But your argument is, though, that you're saying that there should be, it should almost be genre specific. So by using that logic, what you're saying is that Bad Company makes more sense in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame than Stevie Wonder.
I think In Living Color makes more sense than In Living Color. I get this confused because I'm Living Color. Yeah, because they had that lawsuit, and now I can't remember who was who. Living Color makes more sense to me than Stevie Wonder.
Well, I don't agree with you on this, but that's an interesting argument. I'm sure you're not the first person who's made it. I think that there's a lot. I mean, because here's the deal. It's almost crazy we've been talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for this long. I mean, how many other things are so universally seen as completely meaningless?
This is why it should be meaningless, though. This is my whole point.
Yeah, but it has less to do with the type of act that they're bringing. It's just that music, any kind of art form like this, is impossible to quantify.
I disagree.
I mean, like with sports, you know, I mean, when we talk about, there's a certain number of hits you can have in baseball, or points you can score in basketball, or yards you can rush for in football, that make it impossible not to include that individual in the respective Hall of Fame. But with music, there's nothing like that. There's nothing but record sales and people's opinion, and those things tend to be absolutely contradictory.
But that's the point, is that we've done a bad job. I just think this was – when it came time to figure this out and properly name all the different genres and do it in a way that things made a little more sense, we didn't. Like when you and I were growing up, it was rock. It was classic rock. There were stations of classic rock, and then it was new wave. And then now it's like there's 15. I can't even – what's the difference between indie and alternative? Like have we even figured that out? Isn't that kind of the same thing?
Okay. Well, indie initially began as a tangible term, meaning the band was on an independent label.
Right.
So that was you couldn't be indie unless you were on a non-major label. Well, then at one point the word indie sort of got co-opted to be a style of music. Modest Mouse on like a major label, but they are still sort of playing indie rock. Indie rock is kind of an aesthetic now. Alternative basically began as the idea that there was music that was being made that was not sort of, did not kind of sit in the same paradigm as what was being on the radio. It was the alternative to mainstream rock.
It was independent rock.
What?
It was basically independent. It's what indie means now. An alternative is mainstream.
It wasn't independent if it was on, you know, like the Smashing Pumpkins didn't play indie rock.
Well, I mean, a counter, I should say. Or non-mainstream, or I don't know, something, college.
Nobody cared about, like, okay, because in, say, in the 80s, what became alternative rock at that time was called modern rock. Which essentially meant that while a band like, say, Motley Crue was playing in the same style of, like, Aerosmith or whatever, Hootsie Doo was playing sort of something that was modern and new and was kind of using sources and source material that was, you know, fringe or whatever. But then when alternative rock became the most popular rock in the country, that's where this designation became confusing.
All right, so I think we solved the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing. If it's a genre that can't have rock attached to the end, you can't be in.
So you would never have hip-hop. You'd never have rap acts.
Not unless we start calling it hip-hop rock. I don't know.
Okay, I guess you're a hardliner. I don't agree with that.
No, I was just saying, like, it goes back to my initial point, which is that we've just done a really bad job of naming the different genres. And it's like there's no rhyme or reason to it. And I have no idea why I have to go to alternative but also indie on iTunes. Well, those are two separate things. I mean, I get the basic concept of it, but it still makes no sense. They should just all be in the same thing.
How does making it more split up create a bigger problem? Wouldn't
because
the fact
we could
that
have,
they were all lumped together, wouldn't that make – if you put all of these things together, if you don't start having – if you don't split these things into subgenres, then the larger problem is that the whole umbrella term is meaningless, which is what you started complaining about, the idea of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, and the same thing –
it was a meaningless designation because it's including every kind of genre.
But it's the same thing with hip-hop and rap. Those now have kind of – that's become blurry.
Yeah, well, how would you designate the difference?
I don't know. I'd come up with more terms. I like terms. What's wrong with coming up with terms?
To me, rap is the way the lyrics are delivered. Hip hop is both the lyrics, the music, and a lot of times like the visual and fashion components. Hip hop is more of a lifestyle. In the same way that rock and roll is kind of a lifestyle now. If someone's living a rock and roll lifestyle, you wouldn't say like, oh, that means that they're living like Nickelback or something.
They're living an indie lifestyle.
That's a lifestyle as well. If you went to Williamsburg right now, you would see many young people living the indie lifestyle, even though they might be rich. You know.
Wait a second. I want to go back to the Hall of Fame concert. The music is really the only thing where this happens, where they just throw people together and they all sing. And for some reason, it's cool. I'm always riveted by it, but it would never work. Like, I guess maybe this is like what Ocean's 11 did. To some degree. Like, this guy, and hey, it's this guy. Hey, they're all together.
Yeah, films are kind of always doing that. Films are always bringing, like, oh, I would have never thought, you know, De Niro was going to make a movie with, Keenan, you know, I don't know. Some other.
But you still need a script.
What?
You still need a script. Like, Ocean's 11 was, I felt like they ad-libbed the entire movie, and they really had no idea what it was going
to
be.
Well, in the same way, when you bring Metallica and Lou Reed together, you have to have a song, so they play some
right.
James. Yeah.
No, but it's like
the song and the script are sort of play the same role. There.
Any combination, whether it works or not, is still like a fun 4 minutes. Does that make sense?
And also because it's one of the rare times when you're seeing something that's not going to happen a bunch of times in the future.
Yeah.
Like it is sort of a one-time event. Hey, I have a sports thing I want to ask.
Wait a second. I'm not done with Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay, let's keep going. Yeah.
What was the most depressing moment of that 4-hour telecast for you?
The most depressing moment?
The moment that made you go, oh, man, I'm old. Or, oh, man, somebody stop this fight. Say, did you have a moment like that?
No, I did not. What did you have a moment like that?
Yeah, the Ozzy Osbourne part, I bummed me out. I'm not sure he should be allowed on stage anymore.
I don't know. He's been that way for a long time, you know. I thought it was interesting that Metallica brought him up. I mean, it was almost like Metallica going out. I mean, I feel like they were somebody who, they're one band. I mean, maybe it wasn't their idea, but it seems like that they really wanted to make it clear that they view Black Sabbath as one of the most important bands of all time. I don't know if the people putting together the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame event would have immediately thought we need to have Paranoid and Iron Man play here.
I actually was the most fascinated throughout that 4 hours. I thought the Metallica set was the most interesting one to me. Because they, all the other bands were kind of like, hey, we're here. It's a celebration. I'm good. This is, Metallica had like a, they seemed like they had something to prove.
Well,
they, I liked it. I mean, I thought they were really good.
It was interesting. You know, it's interesting to me to see them sort of in the rock canon now.
Yeah,
that they're now a canonical band. I certainly would have never thought that when I was listening to them in the 80s. I would have never, ever imagined that not only would they be asked to be involved in this kind of event, but that they would, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that they have become much more, I mean, when a band kind of like, you know, like James Hetfield doesn't drink anymore, and like the guitarist seems like he's kind of cleaned up his life to a degree, and they got this young bass player. It's like if you're not having fun in your life as a musician, you start getting really sort of bogged down on your legacy. And I think that they're very aware of what, you know, of how they could or could not be perceived later on.
Well, you know what's interesting, but what was interesting about them being chosen to play, and I thought it was a good choice, and I wasn't against it, but like, you know, Van Halen, for instance, which from, I'm going to say, when I was in fifth grade to maybe through ninth grade, was the number one rock band.
Yeah.
And now have just kind of become this historical afterthought. But yet Metallica gained steam. What are the factors for that?
It is surprising. You know, there was a period in the late 80s and early 90s when there was suddenly this sort of critical reconfiguration of Led Zeppelin's legacy. And Led Zeppelin had always sort of been a really populist band that seemed kind of outside the canon, and all of a sudden people were saying, you know, Led Zeppelin was the best band of the 70s. And this is sort of a history of rock criticism that these bands that they don't like, who exist for a long time and make a big impact, eventually the people who were their fans become writers and sort of reverse that polarity. And I assumed the next band that was going to happen to was Van Halen. I assumed that there was going to be this period in probably the late 90s or the beginning of the turn of the century where there would suddenly be this assumption that Van Halen was this really great, really important band. And the exact opposite has happened. Their esteem has actually went down.
They have no shelf life at all.
They don't, and well, for one thing, the really innovative guitar style that Eddie Van Halen introduced, for whatever reason, seems now, say it's a fad would be wrong, but it had less staying power. It seems kind of like AstroTurf to people now. Like it seems like this really, I mean, it seems like this really kind of a synthetic, sort of amazing, confusing thing that over time may have been detrimental to the overall machinations of the art, you know?
Wait a second. I think I figured it out. Don't you think of the biggest factor is if the band doesn't stay intact?
That was a huge part. I was kind of getting that. But moving to Sammy Hagar, that wasn't sort of that. All things considered, that was probably as successful kind of a transformation as you could hope for, you know, and that I think they probably, I'm sure of it, that at least at the time of their release, they had sold more records with Sammy Hagar than with David Lee Roth. But then when they got rid of him and got Gary Cherone, it did start, what it always reminded me of is, like Eddie Van Halen looked at his guitar playing the way the makers of the Dukes of Hazzard looked at the General Lee.
Oh, I like that.
They thought that this is the whole show. It doesn't matter if it's Bo and Luke driving this car. We can just get these other guys, Coy and Vance. We'll put them in there. It's the car that's the star. It doesn't matter who's driving it.
Yeah, that was
a
mistake.
And I think Van Halen, that he sort of, that Eddie Van Halen kind of came to the conclusion that it didn't matter who was singing. As long as he was playing guitar, they were awesome. And that's just not how it is. I mean, there's no band who's like that. I mean, you know.
But I'm not just saying staying intact from the get-go, but I mean, if they were intact now, and they were, like, let's compare them to Bon Jovi. Bon Jovi is certainly not a band that I still expected to be hearing from in 2009. Like, if you had told me in 1984, these guys are going to be around 25 years from now, Van Halen or Bon Jovi. I mean, obviously, all of us pick Van Halen. And now Bon Jovi is like, you know, they're the musical act on Saturday Night Live. They played the same type of music they've been doing for 20 years or whatever. And now for basically anybody under 30, I would think they would think Bon Jovi was had a higher ceiling than Van Halen. I don't know. What do they think? Like, just because they've been around for longer.
At their height, Bon Jovi probably was bigger than Van Halen at their height.
Really?
Because the thing is, Van Halen was more important for a longer period of time, made better records. I mean, I'm not like I like Bon Jovi more, but I'm saying at the period where Bon Jovi was really huge, their female fan base was so big, and they were still sort of perceived as part of, you know, pop metal or metal, so they had the big male audience too. I mean, those records were really massive. Plus, they existed at a time when MTV really powerful. So it was really hard to sort of escape from Bon Jovi at that period. Also, Bon Jovi just had different motives than Van Halen. I mean, they were, from the very beginning, I think John Bon Jovi was in this for the long haul. I think that he was probably thinking about what it would be like to be a musician in 25 years when he was writing Runaway. Well, Van Halen did not think that way at all. I think that Van Halen very rarely looked beyond their next record.
You just made me think of a topic that I've thought maybe 10 times but never have written down or remembered to remember. All right, we kept going with Chuck Klosterman for so long that we had to split this into two parts. Stay tuned for part two of the BS Report with Chuck Klosterman coming up soon.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important news, which frankly cannot go unstated. Whether tailgating, watching the game with friends, or just really hungry, attack your hunger with Subway Catering. Pile high platters starting at $25, giant subs, cookies, drinks, and more. So find a reason to party, put Subway Catering in charge, and get busy feasting. Subway. Cater fresh.